our competitions are coming up soon. Get your phone, have it close to you, because I'm going to be ringing someone very, very soon. But I just don't want to rush my chat with William Porter here, because it's really important. And I think, and as I was saying to you just before we came back here, maybe not on the scale that you've experienced, but this story will resonate with a lot of people out there. And I think there's, you had a lot of opportunities to give in, to stop, to sort of say, I can't do this anymore, or the system is so against me, I can't beat them. I can't listen to any more advice, because every time I do, it almost makes things worse. I think you showed incredible love of your children and strength through your friendship. And it sounds like your mum was your rock there as well, to stick through this. So in the last few minutes then, William, we could do 3 or 4 hours on this, I think, and it's such an important story, it would be justified. But you've applied for custody of your children now at this point. Yeah. Your son is with you.
Yeah.
You were advised to do so at that point. There is someone within the system admitting that you were the victim of a witch hunt, effectively, by the system.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That's what it was.
North and South.
North and South. So what
Moving forward, on the 23rd of June 2016, I'm in court. Judge Loughran's adjudicating that day, and she brings Rachel under my care after me having a lengthy battle with my ex-wife's barrister and solicitor, and she brings her under my care. And I'll never forget her words. She says, "This is a great day for Rachel." You know, and I remember my legs went sort of weak.
But for the right reasons this time.
Yeah. And I remember I come outside the court and I sat down the steps of the court, and I walked my wee car down, she was down the bottom of the hill, and I just was totally overcome. And I just give thanks to the Lord that, because I had prayed in 2009 that I would get her back, and it took me 7 years. And that's a number of completion. And she was back after 7 years, you know, we got her home. And really then, you know, it was just wonderful that she could be reunited and spend her time back in the farm and be with her granny and granda. And she loved her granny. She loved her granda so much. They were so close, you know, and he had missed her desperately, you know, when she was away, because they were so close. And it was just...
And him probably bottling it up. I don't know if he was or was he a very expressive person, but the grandads tend to sort of...
He did. They bottled it up, surely, but he broke a few times.
They feel it, but they don't show it necessarily.
No.
They feel it in a real level.
So we got her back.
Yeah.
And... really then, Greg, I run into health difficulties myself. I took a frozen shoulder on my left side. It moved to the other side. During 2016 and 17, my arms, I couldn't get my arms up above my shoulder height at all. And I went, my friend took me for scans, and nothing was showing up in the scans. And it ended up, it was just pure pressure, and the pure body stress. Was just starting to shut down. Other things too, I found a cyst, so I did. I thought the worst, thank the Lord it wasn't. And, you know, those things were all going on. And during this time, 2016, I'd went to Pearce about the Southern situation, because I was getting no joy from Tuzzle. They wouldn't eradicate the records. Mm. And Pearce got involved, and God bless Pearce. I just cannot thank him much for what he'd done, you know. He started to work for me on the Southern side, on that end of things.
So the records cleared in the
South? Totally cleared.
The records cleared. And even an apology from Tuzla.
An apology from Tuzla. And we got a review set up under the case in 2017, and I met with a guy from Tuzla down there on 9 occasions, also 7 with the clinical psychologist, of 9 with this guy.
Yes.
And he recommended a full apology, so we did. You know, there was... And he stated, he says... The two cases are inextricably linked. The two are inextricably linked. So that, you know, that was a recommendation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then moving forward in 2016, I got the residency order. Pearce become involved, started to work on the Southern thing for me, which I wouldn't be here today. And I can't reiterate enough how much Pearce helped me. And the review was carried out of the case. Full apology recommended, and that apology come in July 2018. And that was a massive lift. My father, I remember when my mum read it to him, he was inconsolable in the room, and it took such a weight.
That's maybe when the pressure was relieved for him. That was his point. You know what I mean? You've had the different, but that was the time where he... you know, the, like the old steam cooker, do you know, letting the pressure.
You know, it was such a relief.
Vindication.
Vindication. Yeah. You know, it certainly was a massive
because
thing.
Because allegations like this cut through your parents' hearts like a knife, because they're worried about their grandchildren, but they're worried about their son. Your son's your son. It doesn't matter if he's... Yeah. If well, he's eight is, or if he's right. 48, he's still...
Well, this is where I have to say, my mum never doubted me for one second. She never doubted. She was a woman of great faith. And, you know, I had a wee girl come to me one time. She says, William, they're saying wild things about you down in the local village. She heard them say in the shop and she confronted mm-hmm. them, you know. Mm-hmm. And she had the courage to come forward to me.
I didn't even think about that side of it.
There was so much of that, but that's one instance, Greg, you know.
I know, but I didn't, in all of this, I kind of in my head was thinking this is all private behind closed doors, but of course it's not. You know, the word gets out.
And, yeah.
Which is painful, and that's painful for the wider family as well.
Yeah.
So what's the situation then? Go ahead.
So there's two other things I need to tell you happened in 2017 with. So what I done, my fear was that there's other people out there. I knew if one man had taken his life, who Pat had told me about. Mm-hmm. Pat left Dublin one night. He said, William, I'm leaving a man here very similar to yourself. I'm going to call you for a cup of tea on the way back. And Pat, he didn't show up, and he rung me at 11 o'clock to tell me that the man had taken his life. You know, this is who severe. This is why I'm here today, Greg, because I want to stop this happening to another family in Northern Ireland or Southern Ireland. Something has to be put in place. And these people in Northern Ireland haven't been dealt with in any way whatsoever. I don't know, we're waiting for word to come back from the minister, what Tuzla have done regarding the South. But it's Northern Ireland is my massive concern at this point, that these people are still in their place of work, which is, like, it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking. But there was two meetings then in 2017 that I had. I finally got a meeting with the CEO of the Western Trust, me and my mum, on the 28th of September 2017. And I asked her 12 questions. The first question I asked her was, are you responsible for these five social workers? And she says, I am 100%. Mm-hmm. And to proceed, I asked her another 11 questions. She answered no comment to every single one of the questions.
Wow.
11 questions based on the welfare of the children. Mm-hmm. She answered no comment every time. I did say to her when I was leaving, I says, you're an absolute disgrace to your position. And I remember looking out at Alton Galvin Hospital, seeing people walking about. I says, those people, I will never stop until I get this sorted out for what has happened here. Then, a few weeks later, I went to social worker E on the 10th of November, so I did, 2017. And I went to her and I says, social worker E, I know her name so well, but I know I can't say it here. I says, I want you to initiate a review into the case, mm-hmm. what has happened. And she says, I won't be doing that, William. You got what you wanted. You're looking for a stage for yourself.
No.
I says, you told me one day that you hadn't got to the bottom of me yet. And I says, I'm not here for a stage. I'm saying, I'm just trying to prevent this happening to another family. And she wouldn't budge. And I didn't. When I was leaving, I says, you know, you have a chance here today to put this right.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't, you will only fuel me. And you know me now, I've come this far. You will only fuel me to get to the end of this and get something done. And her words to me were, and I have to say, I had a regard for her, but here's what, when I lost my regard for her. She says, the trust have dealt with a lot of bigger people than you and their time.
So there's sort of an institutionalised, we dictate what goes on. And right, so...
So that brings us on then to 2018, Chris, Chris and me, I was speaking to my nephew this morning.
I know you have a few important Chris's in your life, so I've been called worse. Go ahead, William.
The apology come in 2018. I just had to go back and say those two meetings in 2017, you know. And one final meeting that I have to tell you about, which was massive. I had been telling the chief inspector over all the police in Oma, a man I got to know pretty well. And I had a meeting with him in September 2018. And I went to the meeting. He wasn't aware that I had the apology this time, but I'd been keeping him in the picture of what was happening regarding everything that was going on. And I went down to him at a two-hour meeting with him. My friend was with me. And I laid the whole thing down and took it from start to finish. And I says, my good man, we have the final piece of the jigsaw here today and you have a job to do. And I threw down the apology in front of him. And he said to me, this is terribly serious. These people need to be removed from their place of work. Well, I says, you have the authority to do it. It needs to be done. He says, I will see if there's something done. He says, we have to go through there and criminal. The criminal, he felt it was criminal what had went on, and I feel it was criminal too. He says, we have to go through the criminal investigation unit in Antrim. But after that, I had that meeting with him
in 2018,
and I never heard a word from him after that. Not one word. I went through the ombudsman, and they came back with nothing to investigate.
And are you pursuing that in the north? Like, is it important? You want your record expunged, cleared up there too? I mean, or could you not say, or does any part of you say, you know what, I've been at this now since effectively 2010, 2011.
Well, my
I'm going to let it slide. Like, what motivates you to keep at it?
What motivates me to keep at this, Greg, is these people are still in a place of work.
It's for other people not to be...
Not to happen to somebody else. Okay. Something has to be done within the system to stop this happening in Northern Ireland again. You know, and this is years on down the line. I even tried this summer to meet with the court children's officer with all this stuff and make her aware of proceedings that had concluded in Southern Ireland last December in the High Court. But she wasn't prepared to meet with me. So it's a clear cover-up. Totally, in Northern Ireland, by the PSNI.
What is the root cause of this? Is any part of this, or was any part of this, about concerns for children's welfare? Or at some point, did you rub people up the wrong way?
No.
And then you were going to... Do you get where I'm coming from?
I went into every meeting gracious. I never raised my voice.
But I'm trying to think, what was the motivation to... Do you get where I'm coming from?
I think
it's not the child welfare, then it must be you or something. What was...
I'll tell you what I think happened. I think there was a lie told at the very beginning. And social workers didn't act, those five social workers didn't act on the benefit of the children. And instead of dealing with a problem that was very early, the whole thing got a snowball effect and it was a snowball they couldn't handle at the end. And I kept hanging in there and it was a snowball they couldn't handle at the end. So that's where we're at today.
All right. Well, listen.
That led us under the court last week. I've told it as, you know, there's a couple of wee things that I've missed here and there. I know there's things flashing through my head. There's so much.
I know. But I think, to be honest with you, what you have told us is it's shocking. It can't happen again, but unfortunately it is happening. And I hope in you speaking out and with the backing that you have that. But I think we can't expect change from, say, for instance, what's happening in Northern Ireland unless it's recognised there was a problem. You see, you can't move forward and sort of make sure this doesn't happen to other people until they say, right, you know, we completely got this wrong and what we did was wrong.
Well, Greg, this is an opportunity now for our minister here in the Republic of Ireland to approach Northern Ireland and get this opened up and get this addressed and get it sorted out. And I would hope that they would be able to come forward and apologise in the north as well, as has happened in the south. Because it's clear to see, as social worker, he admitted to me, as the Tuzzler representative who carried out the investigation into the case, said, I sat in a meeting with the CEO of Tuzzler, and he admitted to myself and a member from Niall, my friend, that this was clearly come from Northern Ireland. They orchestrated this. Yep. This was a witch hunt. And I have to compliment them all. I got to give them 10 out of 10. They give it a damn good try.
Well, they nearly destroyed you.
Yeah.
Only for your own resilience and the people around you and Deputy Doherty's interference. They may have succeeded.
They may. They probably would.
Okay.
You know, I just want to finish by saying...
Yes, William.
I know I'm probably on here far longer than I should be.
Well, it's Wednesday now. No, I'm only joking. It's important, William. Go on, finish up with what you want to say.
You know, people would come and say to me, how did you do that or how did you get through that?
Yeah.
And what I would say to people is that I read Psalm 51 every morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a sinner myself and my son is before me, Greg. I'm not a perfect person. I'm not a perfect parent. And I want to say to forgive all these people who have done what they've done to my family.
Mm-hmm.
If they were here now, I would say to them, I forgive yous. And the only reason I got through this was there's two verses that stand out for me so much as my mum used to always say this to me. I can do all through he who gives me strength. And no weapon formed against me shall prosper. And the only reason that I'm here today is because of my belief, full belief in the Lord Jesus Christ, or I would not be here today. And I would never have got this far. Pierce helped me. I had close friends around me. But that's the reason I'm sitting here today, to tell this story. And I would pray that something could be done, that this would not happen to another family. That's what I would ask. In Jesus' name I pray.
On that note, listen, thank you for all your time this morning. I appreciate it. It's a very difficult story to have to relive, because in timelining it and picking up particular meetings and instances, you happen to go through that again, and that emotion that you felt on those days. But I think, as you say, it's important, and we need to change a system that, you know, it needs to be held to account. But William, for now, listen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Greg, for having me.
And best wishes to you and all of your family. We're joined on the programme now by Professor Paul Dunlop, School of Geography and Environmental Science, Ulster University. Good morning, Paul. Sorry for coming to you a little later than we anticipated.
No problem, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
No, it's important to have you on. And Andreas Lehmann, Group Leader with Concrete Technology. Good morning to you, Andreas.
Morning, Greg.
Oh, you are there. Thank you. I couldn't see you for a moment. Great to have you with us. Paul, I might start with you, if that's okay, because... you know, work is continuing in terms of, you know, analysis, investigation, research into what is causing thousands of homes across Donegal and the country to fall to bits effectively. And we're learning all the time, and there's been quite a significant breakthrough, hasn't there, been, in terms of understanding defective concrete and the extent to which it damages the property, both above and below ground, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you're well aware that we were commissioned by Geological Survey of Ireland. They run a large research project, €500,000 research project, that was funded by Department of Housing, Local Heritage, Local Government and Heritage. So this is effectively, you know, government-funded research, and we were commissioned to look at defective concrete block homes in Donegal. And we've looked at the outer leaf, inner leaf, rising blocks, and also for the first time, the foundation concrete, the strip foundation, which hasn't been looked at before. And we have found direct evidence that the primary mechanism of failure is a process known as internal sulfate attack, which is caused by pyrotite. It's happening on the inner walls, outer walls, rising blocks, and there's also the beginning phase of that with sulfur being released in the strip foundation. So that's the first time we now know that basically all concrete units in the house are at risk of failure and failing quite badly, particularly in the outer leaf.
So just in relation to that, it won't happen, will it, at the same pace necessarily as the outer leaf and then the inner leaf, but it would seemingly then make no sense to rebuild a house on top of these foundations, because over time, and that's yet to be determined, they are likely to fail.
Yeah, well, it's clear that the problem is sulfur that's being released from pyrotite, which turns into sulfuric acid and starts chemical reactions in the concrete. And then the foundations that we have looked at on this research project, we have found clear evidence that pyrotite is at the early stage of oxidizing, which is releasing the sulfur. And once you've got the sulfur released into the cement and the concrete, then you've got the potential there for internal sulfur attack to progress. It's going to progress at a slower rate for different reasons. And I have to leave at 11:25, so I'm going to pass on to Andreas, and Andreas can take you across on the technical details.
Come here, Paul. Do you know,
but there are different conditions that will dictate whether it happens at a faster or slower rate.
And I know you're having another appointment, and this is completely our fault, Paul, and we will return to it. But so as you have time, I'll say goodbye to you now. And I know Andreas is, I think he's got the qualifications to carry this forward, hasn't he?
Yeah, you're in good hands.
He'll be all right. Okay, listen, Paul, Professor Paul Dunlop, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate it. So, Andreas, what does this mean then in terms of the current scheme and its current workings? We can't have sort of the scheme and the science and then this science sort of running side by side and not intertwining, can we? It would make no sense.
Of course, the results of the research, they have to directly flow into the decision making. And, you know, right now we know that the rising wall and the foundations are affected as well. And if you have this internal sulfate attack, you have different phases. You have a first phase that is linked to the formation of ettringite that causes expansion, and the second phase linked to the formation of thomasite that causes strand loss. Now, if you look at the different components of a home, the outer leaf strongest affected is at the beginning of the strand loss phase of the three affected houses that we have now looked in. And the rising wall is in full swing. It's expanding. And we are at the very early stage in the foundation. This causes, well, has different implications. Now imagine you have a your home is standing on a rising wall that, let's say, expands 1%. If your rising wall is 2 meters high, this will uplift your entire home for 2 centimeters. And this, of course, it's inhomogeneous and it will cause cracking. So this is terrible.
So, I mean, what does this... I'm sorry to ask the basic question, because I think an awful lot of people listening to us, particularly those affected by it, will really... The science is important, but will want to know what it means for their homes and really for the scheme. So, you know, the scheme, there are buildings still working through it. There's options, you know, different options, outer leaf, inner leaf, demolition. There's still no decision seemingly on the foundation. So some people might go, well, I don't want to progress if I'm going to end up having to toss this house again in 10 or 15 years. So I know it's the government's job to sort of work with the science that you're providing, but what do you think this means to the current scheme and how we're resolving the problem of defective concrete?
Conclusions is clear. Everything has to be removed, outer and inner leaf, clearly the rising wall. And then, I mean, it's a question, what is a home built for? Is it a one-generation home, or shall it be a family home for more generations? If you look at a longer time scale, then it's clear the foundation has to be replaced, because these homes that we have studied are 20 years old. And yes, we have the start of internal sulfate attack, and we will have expansion at one point. And if you think, okay, a home is for 20, 25 years, then you're okay. But if you think in longer time scales, I would clearly recommend the foundations to be replaced.
Is this, with all the science that has been done, is this very specific to a specific area where quarrying takes place and the quarrying practices? Or are you finding out anything that expands your concern beyond where it seems the majority of this concrete came from?
It is the source of the aggregates is clear where it is, and all the concrete that was produced with this type of aggregate has the potential to be deteriorating, cracking, and so on. Of course, we know of other quarries that contain iron sulfates as well. For example, we know the Mayo cases with the Frombidol pyrite. That is a problem as well. But the pyrotite here in Donegal, that's all coming from the same rock formations.
All right. I mean, this is incredibly valuable information, not just for us here in Donegal, but this work that you've been doing has global ramifications, if you know what I mean. I know it's going to be unveiled in Quebec, but, you know, this is really important information, I think, for every country going forward.
I think so. And it clearly shows that the standard for aggregates, the European standard, that clearly specifies the upper limit of sulfur present in your aggregates if you have pyrotite, that this is more or less correct. Because the homes that we have investigated now, the sulfur content is far above this limit value. And if there would have been any action to make market surveillance in Ireland at the point or from the point where this standard was published, 202, then the entire disaster would have been preventable.
All right. It is fascinating stuff. I'd love to return to this with you and the professor when it's just been one of those days here, Andreas. But thank you so much for your time. It's great to have access to someone who's leading this research because it's so critical. Thank you so much. Have a lovely day. That's Andreas Lehmann there, who is a group lead with the concrete technology. And we heard too from Professor Paul Dunlop, School of Geography and Environmental Science, Ulster University. It is the 9 till noon show. Coming up very shortly, we are going... Just a note in here from Councillor Frank McBurty. We are the first to expose the foundations by testing them, and we are the first to have Petrol Lab do the sulfate attack analysis, proving mica is not the cause of the structural defects in this scandal. That's fantastic. The more of us, especially intelligent people such as the councillor there, if we're all working together, I think we'd even get to a resolution on this even more quickly. I'm not saying that I don't know the ins and outs, but the sooner we're all on the same page, I suppose, it's better, is it? I don't know. Right, okay. Right, someone's phone's going to be ringing in the next 10 to 15 minutes. That person is just going to win €1,000. It's simple as that. The only caveat is that you must have entered the card draw. Many of you have. We have 1,000 to give away today. Hopefully someone answers the phone within 5 or 6 rings. If they do, they win the 1,000. It's as simple as that. If not, it's rolled over. There's going to be €10,000 in cash given out over the next 5 to the next 10 working days, Monday to Friday. So effectively, 3,000 could go on Wednesday. You get me? Just want to make sure that everyone knows what's what, because it does roll over. But hopefully, and I think the Northwest is beside their phones. We're going to be doing that very shortly. So bear with us. And also, too, someone's going to come on and win a fantastic prize from McGee's. It's all about the giveaways. Stay right where you are. Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show. So as you know, we have our big car draw, which is ongoing here at the moment. We have a beautiful new car worth over €30,000 for you to win just before Christmas. And then lo and behold, we decided to mix things up a little bit, and we are giving effectively €1,000 a day away over the next 10 working days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. So we're going to give away, hopefully, our first €1,000 right now. So let's see if the person is listening and takes the call. Hello, are you there? Hello, yes, hello. Is that Anne?
Yeah, this is Anne.
Hi, Anne. This is Greg Hughes at Highland Radio. How are you?
Oh, my God.
Are you well?
I am good.
Come here. Did you enter the card draw by any chance?
I did,
because
yeah.
You know, as part of that, we're giving €1,000 away a day, and yours was the lucky winning ticket that was drawn out a couple of minutes ago. We've rang you. You've answered your phone. You know what that means, don't you?
Oh, my God.
You've won €1,000. You've got €1,000 in your pocket, and congratulations to you.
Oh, thanks a minute.
No problem. And you know,
I just won the credit union car there about a month ago.
Really? Okay, well, now you've €1,000 to fill up your credit union free car with petrol or diesel for the next God knows how long. Do you have the lotto numbers?
No.
Are you always this lucky? Has this just been a lucky couple of months for you?
Just a lucky couple of months. I've never won any in my life.
Well, there you go. It's like buses now. You'll probably win it again, knowing you, Anne. So your number is back in the draw drum, okay? So theoretically, you could be getting another call over the next couple of weeks to win €1,000. Or indeed, you could have your second new car of the year if you're lucky enough, just as we do that draw in the run-up to Christmas. But for now, Anne, congratulations. You have €1,000. What are you going to do with it?
Oh, I don't know yet.
Just put it in the glove box of your new car and drive around the place, your new credit union car. All right, brilliant stuff, Anne. I'm delighted for you, and it's good to hear people having a bit of luck. Fair play to you. Stay listening on the run-up to Christmas. You could win again. Who's to say?
Oh, thanks
for my interest.
Thank you.
Take care, Anne. Bye-bye. That's Anne Doherty there, who won our first €1,000. Another €1,000 will be given away tomorrow across the programming here in Highland Radio. So you have to listen right across the day. You don't know when it's going to be drawn out. We might give you a wee indication, but anyway. So that's the first €1,000 winner in the bag. We'll be back with more on the 9 till noon show after this quick break. Now, our Monday focus is focused on road safety. As Christmas approaches, we remind you to stay safe on the roads and remember to buckle up, obey speed limits, and never ever drink or drug drive. And to try and drive home that message, we have in studio with us Inspector Seamus McGonigal, head of the Roads Policing Unit here in County Donegal. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us, Seamus.
Good morning, Greg.
We also have in studio with us John Joe McGowan, Chief Ambulance Officer with the HSC Ambulance Service based in the West. Thank you so much for joining us as well, John Joe. And what we're engaged in here is actually really incredibly simple, is that we have a thing in this country that wreaks death and devastation on individuals and families, and to a great extent, it is completely avoidable. Now, I mean, not completely, but this is in our gift not to ruin this period or make it a nightmare for families going forward as it ends up being an anniversary or whatever. And Seamus McGonagall, Inspector Seamus McGonagall, that's what this is all about, isn't it? You're trying to urge people to do all the right things and best limit the chances of losing their lives or having life-changing injuries on our road.
Correct, Greg. As I've said here before, we don't really have road traffic accidents. We have road traffic collisions. And as you rightly point out, these collisions are avoidable in the vast majority of cases. And again, we speak of these lifesaver offences. Drugs and drink driving, speeding, not wearing your seatbelts, and using mobile phones or other devices when you're actually driving. If people adhere to the rules, these collisions would not take place. These people that are deceased on the road, you see the figures increased again nationally this year. These people would be here for Christmas this year rather than deceased.
And obeying speed limits that are below the 100 kilometres, you know, the 60s, the 50s, the 30s. I know we say it in the past that these aren't targets, you know what I mean? These are the upper limits. But the difference in the outcomes of a collision dependent on speed, there's some interesting information here. I don't know if you want to go through it, if you want me to read it, Seamus, but, you know, the speed is a huge factor in the outcomes of these collisions.
I think, Greg, it's all about an appropriate speed. We have speed limits, but they're the maximum safe speed you can drive in perfect conditions. But often because of weather or other variables, we might be, say, 50 on the sign, but driving at 50 kilometres an hour in a particular set of circumstances is completely and wholly inappropriate. So it's all about driving at an appropriate speed for the circumstances at any given time. And as you correctly point out, and I'm sure John Joe from the Ambulance Service is all too aware of it, the faster you're driving, and the more likelihood is there'll be serious or fatal consequences if you collide with another vehicle or pedestrian.
Yeah, because we all have to share the roads. So this data really applies to pedestrians involved in collisions. And it really is quite shocking, the difference, potential outcomes at 60 kilometres per hour versus 30, John Joe.
Yeah, Greg, it's huge, the consequences that speed, and as Seamus says, drink and drugs affect road users and affect the consequences of accidents. And I suppose Christmas is such a special time, really, and then every time of the year is a devastation to have the word come to some people's door of a fatality in a road traffic accident.
It's everyone's worst nightmare.
But at Christmas, I suppose it really hones in on it. We like to think on it, your head's like an egg and the yolk is your brain. And you see how fragile that is. There's not really much difference between that and your head and creating head injuries, even at very low speeds. Like if you take it now for the likes of Christmas and presents and e-scooters, quad bikes, all that that goes with it. And it's so simple to come off them, have a serious head injury and be left with devastation consequences through a whole family.
And it's not always speed either. It's how you fall.
Yeah,
what
very
you hit,
simply
isn't
fall.
It, you know?
Like we've even seen consequences of people slipping and falling on ice and having devastating injuries. But as you said at the very start, there is simple things that we can do to try and avoid this. Even, and I've noticed it myself over the last number of weeks, people walking on roads without high-vis jackets, it's lethal, to be honest. And them small things, all the small things really make a huge difference. We break it down at Christmas. I suppose Christmas is the perfect time because it's everything. It's a risk manager's worst nightmare because there's everything going on there. But we break it down into the young and then the older groups. And for the young, it's the likes of the Christmas present. Myself and Seamus was hightailed to a meeting with for Santa and his Elf and Safety Committee a couple of weeks ago. And they have promised that if the likes of the scooters and that are delivered on Christmas morning, that there will be helmets and all that delivered with it. And we know, look, it's not cool to be wearing the helmet and the high-vis and the knee pads and all that there, but it's things like that saves lives.
Yeah. And also to Seamus, You know, some people will take risks all the time, but I think particularly at Christmas or festive periods or a bank holiday, that there's a decision that's made, a split decision. It's like, right, is there not a taxi? I'm going to walk home in my dark clothes. I can't get a lift home, but there's a car there with five people. Sure, I'll hop on their laps in the back. Or, you know what I mean? Sometimes these awful scenarios come from that split second decision that we make. How do we, and often maybe can be under the influence, okay, or any of us here, you know. So it's trying to get people not to make that decision that leads to a chain of events.
I think there's an onus on us all, and I say us all, you know, to make that sensible decision, not to give in at the last minute. And of course, all our inhibitions are reduced slightly when we have alcohol on board, again, which the vast majority of us all do, especially so over the Christmas period. But it's incumbent on us all to make this sensible, responsible decision and don't take that chance. Because you're not just taking a chance with your own well-being, you're taking a chance with it for other road users and other citizens, your other friends and families and people around you. Mm. So you just stop and think. Before you make that foolish decision, stop and think and don't do it.
Do you think we as parents or whomever is a parent need to sort of say as the, and this is not just about young people, but focus on them for a moment. You know, you're, I don't know, 16, I don't judge, 16 to 28 year olds, maybe they don't have a car or whatever it might be, to say to them, by the way, I don't care if it's 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. If you're stuck, call me.
That's such an important, yeah.
Anyone wants to get that call, don't they? Rather than, I know landing at the door with the car coming off, you know?
I speak to my daughter and I say, do not get into a car with somebody who's intoxicated, you believe may have been drinking early in the evening.
Yeah.
You know, you have to stop and think. It's no point saying, Asher, I'm not driving myself, I'll take a chance, I'm stuck for a lift, whatever. There is no reason to get into a car with somebody who's intoxicated. Mm. And yes, absolutely, as a parent, it's incumbent, again, upon us all as parents, to tell our children, yes, we'll go and collect you if we have to, no matter what.
Yeah. We'll get you home one way or other.
And it may affect our own socialising at home, even, nowadays. But if that is the case, you have to be aware. I know at times there are an awful lot of taxis out there, but there can be a shortage of taxis. So we have to leave ourselves as parents to be in a position to collect our youngsters, if necessary, and bring them home safely.
Yeah, and John Joe, often we talk about, and it came, some of this, we say this over and over again, but you know what, I don't apologise for it. We'll keep doing it until we you know get to the purse, because we don't know who we get through. We do get through to people, right? So hopefully we're making a difference. But obviously it's fatalities, which is the figure that's often talked about. It doesn't talk to the serious injury, the life-changing injury, the court cases, the everything else that can flow on from that. You see that. The majority of calls you respond to aren't probably fatal, but you would see some awful situations where you know that person is going to have to live with the injury sustained for the rest of their lives, potentially. And that's what we need to focus on as well, I think, us as individuals.
Indeed, Greg. Like, we hear the fatalities on the radios and the statistics in relation to fatalities, but for every one of them fatalities, there could be at least 2 or 3 serious road traffic accidents with patients left with head injuries or disabilities in relation to that after the accident. Me and Seamus just talked about this before we come in here. And that's a bigger number, and it goes unseen somewhat. And just adding to Seamus's point earlier in relation to the piece of ringing home and that there, pre-planning really takes the spur of the moment decisions out of it and nearly takes that. So even if it is a little bit awkward, I know some of it going Christmas nights out, but have it pre-planned, your route home, and somebody's going to pick you up or something like that there. But yeah, indeed, the devastation that can be left behind by where there's not a fatality is, and that goes on for people, the rest of people's lives, living with disabilities and that there, and it leaves serious consequences behind it.
Drinking drugs, I think, particularly drugs, but certainly drink, that we have to understand how it affects us. You can't really drink and drive at all anymore. You know, people remember the old don't slipper into fifth and that stuff. Bottom line is you don't want any drink on you at all if you are driving. And people will be tempted to drive the next day. And there are checkpoints out there. You know, there's a lot of conversations been had about them in the past, but you just have to stumble across the one and that's that. But that's getting caught. It's not about getting caught really as such. It should be about, am I fit to drive? Should I be driving? And I think there's not a lot of understanding out there about how drugs work on the system and how long they stay in the system, Seamus.
Well, I don't want to get into the minutiae of the of drug driving.
Yeah.
But there has been an increase in people being stopped for drug driving in daytime hours. You know, that's very, very obvious over the last few years. So even whether it's, apart from drugs, even drink can stay in your system for a considerable amount of time. And I'm well aware of cases where people who have been drinking the night before and had no interaction with drugs other than and alcohol ended up being over the limit the next morning. So it's again just appealing to people to think about it. Don't take it for granted you're going to be sober and fit to drive in the morning time. Factor that into your planning as well for the night before.
And road conditions are our responsibility as well too. I mean, obviously we can talk about surface water and potholes and what have you, but that being said, we know the roads for the most part, and it kind of is our responsibility to make sure that we're driving at an appropriate speed. No one wants an anti-state, so it is our call. Like.
It goes back to appropriate speed at all times. Mm. It's such an important issue that people think, oh, the speed limit's 100 kilometres an hour or 80 kilometres an hour or whatever. But especially at this time of year, it's never mind the weather. Even when it's dark, we should be driving so when it's dark than in daylight. You know, roads are affected by water and by ice at this time of year. We just have to take cognizance of that at all times.
So, I mean, the message is kind of clear. If you're a pedestrian, don't walk on the road in dark clothes on the wrong side of the road. You know, have a light, have high vis on. Don't get into a car drunk or on drugs or with someone drunk or on drugs. Don't get into a car that you suspect someone driving has drink or drugs on them. Don't overload vehicles. They're not built to carry multiples of people. It's just to reset ourselves to think about the common sense stuff, John Joe.
Yeah, like we've been at many accidents throughout the years, myself and Seamus both. And I would say what you've talked about there wasn't one accident that some element of that them incidents has come into it, unfortunately, and probably ended up then being the root cause of a fatality or a serious injury at them accidents. So yeah, that's the main, really the main message in all of this. And I know we're like a broken record repeating it, but it is what's happening out there. So that's why, hence why we
like we were going to talk about a road safety thing. I can't remember exactly what it was, but we didn't want to talk about it when there had been a serious collision because it would be insensitive to the families. And it got to the point where we had to defer it 3 or 4 times because things, you know, serious instances were happening. But anyway, we did discuss it. It's very important to note 172 people have lost their lives so far this year, which doesn't actually talk to the absolute devastation far beyond that, Seamus.
In terms of fatalities on roads in Donegal in particular this year, and sadly we've had 9 people who've lost their lives in Donegal this year. Now, so often I've been here and throwing out statistics on fatalities and serious injuries and whatever. But if I may take a moment just to remember each of those people who lost their lives this year in Donegal. That's Eileen Kennedy, Rebecca Brown, Conor McGinley, David McLaughlin, Mary Borland, Ronan Wilson, Arnold White, Alana Harkin, and Thomas Gallagher. Now, God be good to all those people. They all lost their lives on the roads in Donegal this year. 9 families who will be devastated this Christmas. And it happens this Christmas and every Christmas beforehand. And I don't want to tie in directly anything to do with the message we're given here today. But again, these people, the names are all in the public domain, and it's only right today that we should remember them and I think name them. Again, we don't want any more fatalities on the roads. We don't want any more serious injuries on the road. And again, it goes back to the message that I keep reiterating. Do not be taking drink and drugs and getting into your car and driving. Slow down to an appropriate speed. Wear your seatbelt and don't be using any devices which will distract you when driving.
I'm going to leave it at that, actually, because it's such a powerful point. We'll leave it there. Inspector Seamus McGonagall, head of the Roads Policing Unit in Donegal, thank you. John Joe McGowan, Chief Ambulance Officer with the HSC Ambulance Service based in the West, thank you both very much for calling in. And just we hope and pray that the message gets through. And we just hope it does. Okay.